The mind is an enchanting thing. It is an enchanted thing, like the glaze on a catadid wing, subdivided by sun till the netting's a legion, like Gieskin playing Scarlatti, like the apotex all as a beak, or the kiwi's rain shawl of haired feathers. The mind, feeling its way as though blind, walks along with its eyes on the ground. It has memory's ear that can hear without having to hear. Like the gyroscope's fall, truly unequivocal, because trued by regnant certainty, it is a power of strong enchantment. It is like the dove neck animated by the sun. It is memory's eye, its conscientious inconsistency. It tears off the veil, tears the temptation, the mist, the heart wears from its eyes, if the heart has a face. It takes apart dejection. Its fire in the dove neck's iridescence, in the inconsistencies of Scarlatti. Unconfusion submits its confusion to proof. It's not a Herod's oath that cannot change. So that's a poem by one of my favourite poets, Marianne Moore, American poet, not well enough known. She's really, really worth reading. And it's her poem entitled "The Mind is an Enchanting Thing." The mind is an enchanting thing. So I want to start my talk by talking about that poem and talking about the mind. So the poem starts, "The mind is an enchanting thing." That's the title. And then the second line is "an enchanted thing," which is a very Marianne Moore-like thing to do. She likes fine distinctions. So firstly, she's saying that the mind enchants things. So in other words, casts a spell. That's what she means in this case by enchanting. It enchants things. So when we approach experience, we enchant it. We put it under a spell. So I was trying to think of an example of this to make it, try and keep it simple. So for instance, I've known some people, and I think probably I myself, when I was younger particularly, easily had the sense that people didn't like me. When I was younger particularly, I still occasionally do, not so much nowadays. Having written a book on friendship, it gets more and more difficult to pull off. But anyway, you can manage it, that's great. I used to definitely think people didn't like me. And that was a pre-conscious view that I had. I didn't really consciously know I had that very much. It just was a view I brought into experience. So what would happen is I would go into a room, into a social situation like this, with the assumption or the fear, unrecognised by myself, or mostly unrecognised by myself, that people wouldn't like me, they would reject me. So, of course, what happened would be that I'd go into a room and either I'd try and entertain everybody to really make them like me, which would just put me under enormous strain. I remember once going to a party, and I remember clearly I put my hand on the doorknob to go into the room, and I remember taking a deep breath and thinking, can I pull it off this time? Can I do that thing that I did to try to make sure that people liked me? Another response, if you've got that interior view that people don't like you, is that you come in with a sense of distrust. So you enter a room and you're looking for signs of people not liking you. And this is what I mean, and I think what Marianne Moore means by it's an enchanting thing, that we enchant things. So we're already casting a spell, and that spell is looking around for any sign that people don't like you. And that means that you'll be very sensitive to the possibility that people won't like you, and you'll read it very, very quickly. What it'll also mean is that you'll go into a room with a slight sense of distrust. And what that appears to other people is that you don't like them. So if you go into a room and you're a bit like, hello, they think, oh, and they step back and think, oh, he's not very friendly. And then, and that immediately confirms your view that, yes, you're right. People don't like you. So this is what the mind is like. We enchant experience. And then we send that that experience is actually the nature of reality. That we go into a room with lots of unpleasant things. People never seem to like me. People always criticise me. People always... Blah, blah, blah. I'm always a victim. And you really start to think that that is just how things are. That that really is the story of your life. I remember when I was younger particularly, I really identified with being a victim. And I had all this sort of story that kind of could show you that I was. So I was enchanting. I was casting a spell on my life. The mind casts a spell, yeah? Everything we look at, everything we think about, everything we, everyone we talk to, we're casting a spell on. We're fitting them into a pattern that we've already got in our mind. Our mind is a pattern-making instrument. So we, if you have a sense that you might not be liked, you'll be looking for that, unconsciously or subconsciously, looking for not being liked, and that will fit very strongly into your pattern. And you'll understand the world through that pattern. That's what we do. That's what minds are like. We're pattern makers. We understand the world through that pattern. So you'll constantly confirm it and constantly, therefore, think it is just true. And you'll constantly, therefore, create your own world. So Maya Moore's poem starts by saying the mind is an enchanting thing. So it enchants things. It casts a spell on our experience. We're not really seeing things as they are. We're seeing them with a spell that we cast on it. Then she goes on to say, is an enchanted thing. So what this means is that the mind itself is enchanted. So not only do we cast a spell, but our mind is under a spell. Do you see what I mean? You not only cast a spell, but your mind is under a spell. And we're under a spell all the time, aren't we? We're under a spell by all the things we learnt as a child, by the views of our parents, by the attitudes of the school that we went to, by our friends. I think we're enchanted, for instance, by the media. We're told what to like and what to not like. We're even told who to like and who to hate. We're enchanted. Our thoughts are very often not our thoughts. They're the thoughts that everyone is having at a particular time. And the classic example of this is fashion. Clothes fashion. But actually, fashion is really just a very obvious example of being enchanted in every sphere of life, from your ideas to the emotions that you think are permissible to the kind of relationships you feel are right and so-called normal. Yeah? So I don't know whether you remember this, but I remember V-neck T-shirts coming in. One had never thought about a V-neck T-shirt. It had never occurred to one. And then suddenly, you know, you're walking down Bethnal Green High Street and there's somebody in a V-neck T-shirt. Before you know it, everyone is wearing V-neck T-shirts. You'd never seen them a minute ago. And now where are they? Who has got a V-neck T-shirt? You know, what happened to them? But there was a moment... Stand up. Yeah, it was nice to keep it. Yeah, keep it. But it's a really good example. They've really suddenly appeared from nowhere and then they sort of disappear. So now it seems to be T-shirts with a scarf over the top. Now, when I was at school, the idea of wearing a scarf with a T-shirt, it seemed completely potty. But now you quite casually see people walking down the street with a T-shirt, the great big scarf wrapped around the top of it. So that's... And what that makes you do, it makes you want to wear a scarf with a T-shirt. And a few years ago, people would have said, you look a real twerp. But now you look really cool. Yeah. So we're enchanted. Yeah. And fashion's a very obvious example of that. Everyone wears the same jeans. Everyone basically wears the fashion that we're dictated to wear. Apart from Jeff. You're the only one who doesn't. So we should hold up Jeff as a kind of offering. I've been very nice. So fashion's a good example of what is happening on much, much deeper levels. In a way, fashion's fairly trivial. It's a trivial matter. But it also is about, you know, the kind of thoughts we have, the kind of things we're allowed to think and feel and so on. So we're enchanted. We're enchanted by the world we live in, by the culture we live in, by the historical moment we live in. We're parochial in time and in space. We're enchanted. Yeah? So one of the things I was thinking about when I was writing this talk, all 2 hours ago, whenever it was, was that for me, I quite often wonder, what kind of person am I? So Dean was saying to me earlier on, he said he doesn't feel like he's a religious person. And I said, I don't think I'm a religious person. He seemed quite surprised. So I thought, no, I'm definitely not a religious person. And then this morning after my meditation, I thought, I'm a religious person. And then, you know, by breakfast, I'm not a religious person. So I'm often kind of wondering what sort of person I am. I don't know whether you have this. What kind of person am I? And actually, in many, many ways, the person we are is simply the results of the conditions we're in. So if you're in this set of conditions, you'll be one kind of person. If you're in the pub, you'll be another sort of person. Who we are is really to do, very much to do, with the conditions we find ourselves in. That's why changing conditions and coming on a retreat like this can have such an effect, because you become a different person by putting yourself in different conditions. I think we're intrinsically naive about this. We have a belief that we really are individual and separate and not affected by the enchantment of the moment. But we are. We really are. Yeah. And one of the signs of spiritual growth is being less enchanted by the moment, being less conventional, basically. And there's ever new ways of being conventional, including being radical and individual, which is, at the moment, one of the most conventional things that you can be. I'll let you think about that. So, yeah, Marianne Moore says in her poem that the mind is a power of strong enchantment. That our experience is enchanted. Our mind is enchanted, and our mind enchants our experience. Yeah. But famously, she ends with this very famous last line. She says, "Unconfusion submits its confusion to proof." I do not understand that line, but never mind. "Unconfusion submits its confusion to proof. It's not a Herod's oath that cannot change." So it's that last line, a very, very famous line of hers, "It's not a Herod's oath that cannot change." So the mind can change, is what she's saying. It's not a Herod's oath that cannot change. And this is what Buddhism is always concerned about. It's concerned with the mind and with helping individual human beings change their mind. That's really it. So when we're talking about Buddhism, we're always really talking about the mind and helping people to change their mind. It's not a Herod's oath that cannot change. And when we're talking about the mind, we need to remember it in all its mystery and all its dimensions. So we're talking about the mind as enchanted by the culture and conditioning that we've just imbibed without noticing it, that we suddenly find ourselves with a V-neck T-shirt, when we suddenly find ourselves with a new political idea, with a new idea about emotion, with a new thing, a new ideology. And it's because you're enchanted by the moment. You're enchanted. We're enchanted by the media. And we enchant our experience with all of those assumptions that we have, those preconceptions that we have. But also the mind is beautiful. It has incredible beauty. Marianne Moore says, "It's like the dove neck animated by the sun." And elsewhere she says, "It is fire in the dove neck's iridescence, in the inconsistencies of Scarlatti." So she's saying that there's something about the mind which is iridescent and beautiful. Talks about the kiwi's rain shawl of haired feathers. This is something very, very complex and beautiful. But she's also saying the mind is dangerous. The mind, feeling its way as though blind, walks along with its eyes on the ground. So when you walk along with your eyes on the ground, you're likely to walk into something. So she's also saying that the mind is dangerous. There are things that you can do in your mind, there are places you can go in your mind that are really dangerous. You just have to have a certain kind of narrative and believe it, and you can get to a very, very dangerous place very, very easily. And when we're thinking about the mind, when we're thinking about knowing the mind and changing the mind, we're talking about the conscious mind. We're talking about learning how to think really deeply, learning how to think in a genuine and creative way. We're also talking about our emotions. We're talking about learning how to feel more fully, and especially feel more positively. We're talking about our views, our beliefs, our pre-conscious beliefs. I got this word pre-conscious from Karl Popper. And he says that we come into life, we always come into life with pre-conscious expectations and assumptions. He thinks that we have a theory already about what life should be, and we fit life into that theory. So, for instance, when you go and catch a bus, you have a theory in your mind that, yes, it can be 5 or 10 minutes late, but you don't think it can be half an hour late. And after the point that your theory allows for, i.e. 5 or 10 minutes, you can start to get really, really impatient. And this shouldn't happen. And you start tutting and looking at your neighbours in the queue and starting to complain about London transport. And it's just to do with the theory that we have in our mind, a pre-conscious theory that, yes, buses come broadly on time within about a 10-minute, quarter-an-hour frame. But if you take yourself to India, a bus can be a day late. Yeah? And you've just got a different theory there. So someone catching a bus in India, they're not going to... 5 or 10 minutes, what's that? That's like nothing. You spend the afternoon... I've never been to India, but this is what I hear. You know? You've basically got a different expectation. You've got a different pre-conscious theory about what catching a bus would be like. Do you see what I mean? So you come into life, I come into life, with already set up theories and expectations and assumptions. And when I get irritated is when those assumptions, expectations, and pre-conscious theories aren't met. So I was using the example in my group of being given a present by someone. So somebody had been away, and they gave me a present, and I felt disappointed. And the reason why I felt disappointed is because it was a smaller present than usual. So this person had been away a few times before, and had come back and brought me a nice present. And this was a bit smaller. So I took it. I said, oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. You know. What am I going to do with that? And it was quite interesting, because I thought, this is very strange. I've just been given a present, but I feel disappointed. What on earth is going on? And then you think, oh, it's because I've got a pre-conscious expectation. I actually am now expecting this kind of size of present, which also tells you about this kind of size of love or this kind of size of esteem. Yeah? And then you start thinking, actually, the present's got smaller, so is love getting smaller as well? And I started to react to that possibility. Is it for me? But I didn't know any of that until I was given a smaller gift. So you don't realise you have expectations until they're not met. Until the bus is half an hour late, until in India the bus is 3 weeks late. Yeah. Then you realise you have pre-conscious expectations. But it's to do with you, isn't it? Nothing to do with reality. Reality does as it pleases. I've got these pre-conscious expectations. Anyway, I didn't mean to say that much about that, so better move on. So I'm talking about what I mean by the mind, all these different elements of the mind, conscious, unconscious, emotional, and so on. So when we talk about the mind, we're not merely talking about cognition, we're not merely talking about thoughts and thinking and how we think, we're talking about our views, our pre-conscious theories and expectations, we're talking about our emotions, we're talking about everything, really. Even we're talking about our body, because our body mirrors our mind, is our mind, in a incorporeal form. So the whole of Buddhism is about knowing this mind and changing this mind. So when you approach Buddhism, you're approaching this question of mind. That's where Buddhism begins, and in a sense, that's where Buddhism ends, in a sense. I'll say a bit more about that later. So what we're trying to do in any spiritual practice, we're trying to grow our mind. We've been using this word bhavana, as in metta-bhavana, and one translation of bhavana means to ripen. So in the metta-bhavana, you're trying to ripen your feelings of loving kindness. In the mindfulness of breathing, you're trying to ripen your capacity to concentrate. In spiritual life, you're trying to ripen the mind. That's basically what we're doing. And if you think about it, that is the central issue of life, I think. is my challenge to you. I think that is the central issue of life. Everything we experience through the mind. Every possible experience we have, we experience through the mind. No other experience is possible. Every single experience we have ever had and can ever have, we experience through the mind. And our mind is enchanted and enchanting. In other words, it's not objective. It's not seeing things as they are. It is enchanted and enchanting. So the whole question of our mind must be central to human life. It must be central to how we grow and develop. It must be central to the big questions of life. There's that famous part in Hamlet where I think, I can't quite remember the quote, but Hamlet says something like, something's heaven or hell, but thinking makes it so. Now, I understand Shakespeare not to mean literally just thinking, but your mental state, your mind, your mood, your attitude makes a heaven or a hell. And that's what Buddhism is talking about. So when Buddhism is talking, it's whispering to you directly about your mind. It's saying, never mind about anything else at the moment. What about you? So do you see when you get irritated with someone, what happens to you when you do that? What happens there? Is that a good thing? Do you feel happy for that? And so on. So it's talking directly to you and to your mind. I definitely don't mean the mind in an individualistic sense, your particular mind. But I'll come back onto that a bit later on. Okay, so that's the mind. So Buddhism is about the mind. It's talking about the mind. It starts with the mind. It's about knowing the mind and helping the mind change. But what is there essential about the mind? What is the essential characteristic of the mind? So if a Martian was to come down and meet us, and if they were then to go back to Mars with their little split heads or whatever they have, like the Smash advert, and if they were to say, if someone was to say, okay, so you've met them, you know, kind of basically, what are human beings? I always think this is a question that we can't answer. It's a very it is the question in a way. What are we? We're not quite an animal, so what are we? So if a Martian was to come down, meet us all, and then be asked, what are we? That Martian would say, they're wishing creatures. The human beings are wishing creatures. That's what they are. They wish. They want. They wish for things. And that's what they are, and that's what makes their life, is that they wish. They want. They yearn. So when I was thinking about this, I was thinking of this film, The Devil Wears Prada. Has anyone seen The Devil Wears Prada? I've seen it twice. For some reason, I find it very, very funny, especially Marilyn Streep. The rest of it's pretty naff, but she's wonderful. And there's this very interesting scene near the end of the film where Marilyn Streep, she's supposed to be the director of Vogue, I think it comes from the woman who's the director of Vogue. And she's with her personal assistant in this limousine coming back from the Paris fashion show, Paris Fashion Week. There's been this big story about the assistant. She wasn't doing very well, and then she becomes marvellous, and then she worked really hard. And just as they're driving up, and they've had this wonderful sort of fashion week, the Marilyn Streep character, her characterization is wonderful of this incredibly powerful woman who's just got everything, who's just at the top of her game in fashion, who's the last word in fashion. And the Marilyn Streep says to the other woman, she says, I really think you've done really well, actually. I'm starting to think I see something of me in you. I start to think that you're actually rather like me. And in the film, you have to see the film to get this, but in the film, that character's thinking, actually, but what if I don't want to be like you? That's what she said, I think. She says, what if I don't want to be like you? And this character says, everyone wants to be like me. And then she gets out of the car and she walks up to this hotel and she's surrounded by photographers and she puts these dark glasses on and she's got this kind of frozen, glamorous kind of world that she's in. And you just get this thing, everyone wants to be like me. I was really struck by that, and I think it's true in some ways. It's really true. Everyone wants to be an A-list celebrity. Everyone wants that kind of intensity of glamour. And I thought it was a very interesting exchange in the car. So that's a wish. That's something we might wish for. Lots and lots of people are wishing for that now, and it's causing all kinds of problems, but that's another thing. So this is the whole issue about wishing and what we wish for. So you get wishes, don't you, in fairy stories. And often, people are given three wishes. You often have fairy stories where people are given three wishes. And what tends to happen is they never wish for the right things, do they? You always think, why don't they just wish for three more wishes each time? That's what they always say. And then you go on forever. It's quite straightforward. Nobody seems to have thought of that. Anyway. So there's one fairy story, for instance, where this goblin or fairy meets this elderly couple in the wood. They're in this little shack in the wood. And this goblin says, okay, well, I'm going to give you three wishes. You can wish for anything you like. I'm going to give you three wishes. And this elderly couple is sitting there. And the man says, I'd like a really big sausage. So there you are, this plate appears, and this great big Frankfurter, the best one you could ever wish. And his wife says, oh, you stupid man, I wish that Frankfurter was stuck on your nose. So then he ends up with this great big Frankfurter on his nose, and then they've got one wish left. So of course the wish is for the Frankfurter to disappear. So the Frankfurter disappears, and you're exactly where you were. So fairy stories tend to have that classic kind of pattern, that they are given wishes, and what they wish for just doesn't work. Because what they wish for is what they think they want. That's the problem. This little elderly couple, the husband, he's hungry, so he wants a great big sausage. He just can't think beyond that as something he might want. So he just wants a great big Frankfurter. So we wish for what we think we want. And that's a real issue. We wish for what we can imagine will make us happy. We wish for what we think will work. So we might wish to be the managing director of Vogue. We might wish to be a celebrity. We might wish for lots and lots of money. And we're going to be, again this evening, talking about treasure and money and the symbolism of that. Of course, you also get this in the spiritual life. We can wish for things in the spiritual life. And sometimes that's right, and sometimes it's wrong. One Buddhist teacher said that we have the potential, we're like acorns that have the potential to be oak trees, but most of us just wish to be bigger and shinier acorns. Because that's what we can imagine as an acorn. What you can imagine is just being like a really, really big, really, really shiny acorn. You can't possibly imagine being an oak tree. So you couldn't wish for it. You see what I mean? And we're in exactly that analogous position. What we can imagine we can wish for, there could be something much, much more. Yeah? And that's what Buddhism is saying. So what are we actually wishing for? So when we want this Frankfurter, what are we wishing for? What are we always wishing for? What is our nature? If our nature is wishing, what are we wishing for? So from a Buddhist perspective, we're always wishing for happiness. All the time, in every situation we're in, we are wishing to be happy. Even the most negative strategies that we get into are a strategy to try to become happy. Even those awful suicidal thoughts that we might have had, it's because we think if we remove all the pain, then in some strange way we'll be happy. Everything we're trying to do is a strategy to try to be happy. That's what we really, really wish for. And this takes us into, the heart of the human problem, if you see what I mean, which is that we wish for happiness, but don't know where it's to be found. And that is what we're born into. We wish to be happy, we yearn to be happy, we really need to be happy, but we don't know how to become happy. We don't know where happiness is to be found. So we're constantly kind of making it up. We're constantly kind of finding new little ways to try to be happy. I mean, I remember when I started smoking. I definitely started smoking because it was me trying to be happy. I thought, you know, you get a bit of a break, you're a bit of a rebel. I started smoking long after I'd been a Buddhist monk. It tended to very quickly get associated with any time I had anything difficult going on between me and other people. I'd go on the roof and have a fag, and then I'd have two fags. But somehow, even all the way through that, it was to do with thinking that that would somehow make me happy. At the same time, knowing that it was actually harming me. So the impulse is still to be happy, even though you know that actually this is actually quite overtly harming me. But that's why I smoked, because I wanted to be happy. I don't smoke anymore, but that's why I smoked then. Okay, so that's the mind, and the essential thing about our mind is it's a wishing mind. And that's what we are as human beings. We wish, we want, we yearn. And we want, we wish, we yearn to be happy, but we don't know how to be happy. And that's our human situation as I see it. So how does this all relate to the White Lotus Sutra? Some people might be wondering when that's ever going to be mentioned. So it does relate very strongly. So all the images, the stories, the parables, the metaphors, the colours, the image, the pictures on the shrine here are all about trying to help our mind ripen and change. It's all about our mind. All the images of jewels, of treasures, of God-like figures sitting on lotuses, it's all about our mind. It's all as if. It's all as if. So when you enter a puja, you enter the space of as if. But it's an as if, but that doesn't mean to say it's a fantasy. It's much, much more serious than that. You're trying to actually get to the ground of reality through the whole being, including their emotions, their non-rational side and so on. You're trying to really move that mind. You can't just do it as a kind of exercise. It's just like going to the theatre when you get really, really moved by Romeo's love for Juliet. And you know full well he's an actor and she's an actress, but that's not the point. The whole point is to be deeply, deeply moved and changed by the experience. And that's what Buddhism's trying to do. That's what the shrine is trying to do. That's what puja is trying to do. It's trying to really change our heart by this as-if practice. You know? By just saying there are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all around us. We just call on them. You know? And that as-if practice is a reality. It's not a non-reality. It's just as real as we are. And we're not as real as we think. So coming back to the sutra itself. So the point of the sutra I want to talk about is the appearance of the stupa. So in the sutra, this is the climax of the whole White Lotus Sutra. You've got the Buddha teaching to this massive assembly. You've had all these parables, all these beautiful images, all this colour and light and jewels. And then, as they're sitting there, in this sort of silence, suddenly this immense stupa appears in the sky. We have... it's a bit like this whole shape. And a bit like that shape. Never mind what shape it is. You have to imagine this immense, beautiful, incredible shape appearing in the bright sky. And it's supposed to be huge, absolutely, massively huge. In the Mahayana Sutras that the White Lotus Sutra is part of, the language is of immense space and an immense time, unimaginably immense. So you have to imagine this incredible thing appearing, miraculous, precious. And it's supposed to be decorated with bells and flags and awnings and incredible kind of architectural... it's like seeing a palace, suddenly a massive palace sitting in the middle of the sky. The closest I can think of it is in the film Close Encounters. There's a fabulous moment in that film where they're all standing waiting for the UFO to appear and someone says, "Watch the skies." And they all put on sunglasses, do you remember? They all put on sunglasses and they all look at the sky and suddenly this thing just appears over the mountain. This incredible thing, doesn't it, appear? And when I saw that when I was quite young, and it was quite the early days of special effects, and I remember thinking, absolute wow. It was just so incredible, you know, to be, you said, "Watch the skies," I really like that. And then this miracle of light appears above this mountain. So it's just like that. You have to imagine that they're all sitting up, and then suddenly this miracle of light appears above them. And then not only does that miracle of light appear above them, but a booming voice is heard from the centre of it, just saying, "Fantastic. Excellent, you're teaching the White Lotus Sutra. Excellent, excellent." This incredible voice. And it's supposed to be like the voice of the rolling tide, like the voice of thunder. This incredibly soft voice, but at the same time, incredibly loud. So all the disciples are sitting there watching this stupa appear and hearing this voice. And eventually one of the disciples, he's named Great Eloquence, and I think it's interesting his name because obviously he's the only one who could eventually get over it enough to speak. Everyone else just like... Oh. And everyone's like... And he says, Shakyamuni, why has that appeared? we were talking about various things and then, Jesus! why has that appeared? So the Buddha says, that's really good, you are. So in a remote time, in millions and millions and millions and trillions of years ago, there was a Buddha, and he gained enlightenment. And he said that every time the White Lotus Sutra was taught, he would appear in his stupa. Okay? That every time, in whatever universe, of the millions and millions of universes, and this is the language of the Mahayana, you don't have one universe, you have millions of universes with millions of Buddhas. Said every time in any universe that Buddha appeared, that the White Lotus Sutra was taught, he would appear. Yeah? So Great Eloquence says, I'd really like to see him. Can we see this Buddha? It's incalculably old, this Buddha. I don't know whether you ever... Did anyone see that exhibition in town called Ashes? You've got this lovely image of a Buddha. I can't remember who the artist was. It was made of ashes from a Japanese meditation hermit. And it looked incredibly ancient. That was the most moving thing about it to me. So you have to imagine that you've seen this incredible thing, this light display, and you're told that in the middle of it is the ancientest thing you could ever, ever imagine, beyond your imagining, this incredible figure that you could just ancient beyond words. And he's there now. If we think what it's like going to see, I don't know, the pyramids or something, that the sense of their ancientness, and then you multiply that by 50,000, something like that. Yeah. So everyone wants to see this Buddha, and this Buddha is called Abundant Treasures. Abundant Treasures. We'll come back to that in a minute. And the Buddha says, okay, so the other part of his vow is that before everyone can see him here in this assembly, I have to gather to me all the Buddhas that have emanated from my body, from all the different universes. So he then sends out this ray of light which shines throughout the universe to all parts of the universe. And in all parts of the universe, which is millions and millions and millions, there are all these Buddhas teaching in all these different universes, and the Buddha can see them all. So his light goes around the universe, and each of those Buddhas say, I'm now going to go to the Saha world, to this earth, because Shakyamuni is about to open the stupa with abundant treasures in it, and I'm under vow to appear. So in the next part of the sutra, all these Buddhas, with all of their retinue, which is, of course, hundreds of thousands, they all come from all different points in space. And what the Buddha does is he changes the earth. So in the sutra it says, all the people on the earth, all the mountains, all the everything that's in the earth, he just moves them elsewhere to another solar system. And then he creates this completely flat plane, infinite plane, of lapis lazuli, studded with jewel trees. So like this, you have to imagine now that the whole world is transformed to this sheen of blue lapis lazuli and this endless orchard of jewel trees. If you looked at the trees this morning with the light, this lovely light shining on them, they start to look a bit like jewel trees. So he creates this world of all these jewel trees. All these Buddhas come in and they all sit under the jewel trees. And all of their disciples come and sit under each of these jewel trees. And then if that isn't enough, each of those Buddhas sitting under the jewel tree says, now you need, they send an attendant to go and ask how the Buddha is. It's a very odd little moment. You've got this incredible cosmic display, and then someone says, just go and check if he's all right. So all of them send their attendant, and they all go and meet the Buddha, and they all ask him, how are you? And they all go back, yeah. So once all of that has happened with millions and millions of people, that the world is completely purified, then the Buddha himself rises into the sky. So he just takes off and rises into the sky. and he opens the door of the stupa. He rises into this. You have to imagine him. This, and he's an elderly man, an unshaven. You know, he's been teaching on earth. He's a just an ordinary human being. Goes up into the sky into this incredible light display and opens this door with this incredible sound. And there inside is abundant treasures. And abundant treasures is exquisitely, scintillatingly beautiful. He looks like a young man. He's not. There's no sense of age in him at all. He's just this incredible light of beauty. And what I find really incredible about this moment is that Abundant Treasures says, Shakyamuni, come and sit next to me. Now, that must have been incredible for these early listeners of this text. So you've got this Buddha, the one Buddha, the Buddha that you're bowing to, and suddenly you've got two. And suddenly you've got this incredible Buddha that's remotely past and yet scintillatingly present, who's sitting on this throne in the middle of the sky, and he says to the Buddha, come and share my throne with me. And then you have the two Buddhas sitting next to each other in this stupa of light. So you have to sort of really imagine that, that you've got this historical person and then you've got this incredible trans-historical person. And I'll come back to the meaning of that in a minute. But and then the last thing I want to mention is then what the Buddha does is great eloquence says, I know that all of us would like to see you better. We're down here. You're now sitting in this stupa with abundant treasures. We want to see you. We want to really just look at you in just incredible sitting next to this other Buddha. So the Buddha raises them all up into the sky to the same level that he's on. And that's where I'll finish this part of the story. But that's in a way the climax of the whole of the White Lotus Sutra. So I just want to say a few things about this incredible drama. In a way, the drama itself is so striking and so unusual. It's just worth sort of turning over again and again in your mind. And no one reading is ever going to be good enough. They just should be reading after reading after reading. But as I was thinking about it, it seems to me that it's an image for enlightenment itself. It's the whole drama, every aspect of the drama, is an image for enlightenment itself. So the stupa, for instance, first of all you get this stupa appearing in the sky. Now the stupa, traditionally, is made up of the six elements. So you've got earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. So the Buddha was, in classical Buddhism, that's it. That's all there is. That's all that can they ever experience. You have the earth element, the solid element. The solid element out here, these things, this is the earth element, and the solid element in here. It's also about the energy element. So there's a part of our energy that's rather solid and even stuck together. Yeah? So we can't know, when I press my hand on this, I can't know what this is. We know that you can think of it in different ways, but if you're a scientist, you know that there's molecules or something racing around very fast. You know, all you know is there's this sense of pressure, of resistance. And that's what the earth element is. It's a sense of resistance in the body, in the mind, out of the body, outside of the mind. Then and so on, for all of those elements, then the water element in the body, out of the body, streams and feel and so on, and urine and so on. And then the fire element, the heat element in the body, the heat element outside of the body. Then you have the air element, the breath in the body, the breath out of the body, the air out of the body, and so on and so on. So, without going through the very complex symbolism of the stupa represents everything. It represents absolutely everything. So that starts to make this sort of drama clearer, that what appears is everything. But you see everything. You're not inside everything. The Buddha's outside everything and can see everything. So he can see all these elements. So basically, you could say, or one way of thinking about it, is that the stupa represents all our mind contents, all the things that we perceive, our mind contents, the categories we come up with. In my group, I was talking about, we have this category of eyes, but there's no such thing as eyes. There's only the particular eyes that you're looking into now. There isn't a general category of eyes. They only ever exist in particular, unique things. And language never describes particular unique things. It always speaks in universal categories and generalisations. There's no such thing as ears or noses or floors or days or weeks. They're just categories of the mind. All we ever actually experience is unique and particular, and language can never express the unique and particular. Poetry tries to, art tries to, but language can never. So the Buddha is outside of it. He can see it all, but he's not part of it all. He can enter it, he can go and sit inside it, but he's not of it. He's outside of it, he's looking at it from outside. He's outside the contents of the mind. He's seeing it as a magical display. So that the stupa, if anything is a magical display, this stupa is. It's like the arising of this, the UFO in that film. It's this magical display. And this is trying to say, this is what the world looks like when you let go of egotism. As soon as you let go of egotism, of me and self and I, you see the world as a magical display. The nearest you can get to, and it could easily be misunderstood, is watching a film. You can watch a film, you can be really, really emotionally involved in it, and all the way you know it's a film. You know, when horrible, frightening things happen, you get frightened, but it's not like really horrible things happening. It's not like that at all. You're involved, but in another way, you're not involved. If someone says, they're only acting, you would say, oh, shit. You know what's happening, don't you? Well, the enlightened mind is something, and you can misunderstand that, but it's something like that. You're involved, you're emotionally connected, but you know it's not ultimately real. You know that it's not really what it seems. Do you see what I mean? So it appears to you like a magical display, like the appearance of this incredible castle in the sky. It really is a castle in the sky. And this is what things are like when you just experience them without adding self to them. So that in a very early teaching, the Buddha said, in the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the cognized, only the cognized. And so on. So in other words, when you look at something, you don't need to add self to it. Self isn't actually there. People were talking about listening to the bird song this morning. This lovely bird song. Now you can just, there could be in the herd, only the herd. You don't need to think bird song, you don't need to think birds, you don't need to think analogies like choruses or whatever. You just completely let go of any kind of description of it, and you just have the herd. Yeah? You don't need to, the self isn't in it. You know what I mean? You can't even say inside or outside, you don't even listen. Marianne Moore says that the mind can hear without having to hear. You just, it's in your mind. You don't have to hear. excuse me. That's what this magical display is like. You're not adding self to it. You're not doing anything with it. It is just as it is. Yeah, you're not involved with it. And yet in another way you are involved. But this image of standing outside is one attempt, I think, to try to communicate enlightenment. That it's as if you're watching this magical display, but you're not in it. So you can watch all this feeling and all the games that we play going on, but you're not playing them yourself. You're not playing status games, you're not playing self games, you're not playing me games, poor me games, great me games. You're not playing any games, you're just watching what's around you, but you're not adding self to it. Yeah? So one way of seeing this image is that the stupa arising is just watching what life is like when you don't add self to it. It's just this incredible display. But it's still a bit negative as an image. So I imagine that the image changes because of its possibility to be misconstrued. The principal image for letting go of self in Buddhism, and in Mahayana Buddhism particularly, is shunyata. So what happens, the image that's used, is once you let go of all self, all sense of I, which is, from a Buddhist point of view, an illusion in the first place, this mind that we're trying to create, this self that we're trying to protect and we're trying to defend, is, you know, to talk technically, an epistemological error. It's an error of knowing. We've got it wrong. We don't have a self. Yeah? So we sort of see through it. And the image that's usually used is shunyata, which is an immense blue sky. And all the Buddha figures that you see on the shrine, traditionally they appear in the midst of Shunyata, in the midst of this immense, endless, infinite blue sky. But you can see that the danger of that image, it's got this incredible freedom and expansivity and amazing freedom, but it could become seen as a void or a gap or a nothing. And this is what's happened very much in Buddhism. It easily starts to be seen that the goal is somehow a nothing, a void. So I take the rest of the images to be an attempt to correct that. So what happens next is that the Buddha changes the whole of the world into this perfect lapis lazuli ground studded with jewel trees. But it goes on infinitely, just like the infinite blue sky. But instead of a blue sky that's, as it were, empty, it's an infinite plain with jewel trees, with Buddhas appearing, you know, every moment. And millions of Buddhas come from all over space with this massive retinue. And suddenly that gives this letting go of self an incredible new content of majesty, of beauty, of abundance. Again, this theme again and again through the sutra is abundance, is treasure. So what was this image of pure freedom suddenly becomes this image of exquisite sort of world. Yeah. And then, of course, you have the appearance of abundant treasures himself. And in the sutra, abundant treasure is supposed to be unimaginably ancient. He's supposed to be kotis and mayutis and asankhya kalpas old, which means, you know, unimaginably ancient. And when a sutra is doing that, when any sort of text is saying something like that, really it's a way of saying it's outside of time altogether. So when we talk about once upon a time, we sort of mean outside of time. Yeah? But when we talk about a figure being unimaginably ancient, we mean that he's outside of time. Yeah? So when he appears in the stupa, you have an image of timelessness. Yeah? Of timelessness. So when the Buddha sits next to him, you have time and timelessness sitting next to each other. This incredible image of time and timelessness just sitting next to each other. And what struck me about it is what an intimate image it is. You know what it's like if you say, oh yeah, come and share this armchair with me. It's a very intimate thing to do. It's not just say, look, I've got another chair here for you. It's on one throne, and you say, come and join me, come and sit right next to me. So you've got time sharing the same chair as timelessness. Yeah? So I think, again, what this is saying is that when you let go of self, when you completely let go of self, you let go of time. Time is, according to Buddhism, is part of the functions of consciousness. All you can say is something is going on. So just as when I touch this table, all I can actually say is that something is going on. I call it resistance, but that's just a word as well, that's just a category. All you can ever say about reality is something is going on. And we call, in terms of the passage of events, we call that time. Yeah? So if you imagine, if we sat here just now, and if you imagine that you were completely attending to everything I was saying, I'm sure you are, you're completely attending to everything I was saying, and I was completely and utterly wholehearted in everything I was saying, every word. And as we spoke like this, as I spoke and as you listened, that we gradually just didn't want anything else. We just didn't want the next word. We didn't want the talk to stop. We didn't want it to carry on. We didn't want to go home on New Year's Day. We weren't looking forward to it. We didn't want anything. If we could just sit here now and not want anything, would time exist without wanting at all anything to stop or start, without that leaning forward into the next moment all the time? Do you notice how when you look at yourself carefully, there's this always leaning forward, like we're always walking to the bus or something. We're always pressing forward into the next moment. It's as if that psychic tendency, this leaning forward, creates time. But if we didn't lean forward at all, if we just were here, would time exist? What would be going on now if we didn't want anything, if we weren't wishing for anything? And what Buddhism is saying is if we weren't, we'd see abundant treasures. We'd become even abundant treasures. But there's a final part which I find particularly moving and relevant, which only occurred to me today, which is, so you've got this incredible display of enlightenment. You're saying that it's involved with the world, passionately involved with the world, just like you might be if you watch a firework display or some beautiful mirage. But you're not in the world, you're not of the world. You're outside of it. Yeah? And then you're saying, actually, that's not enough. You've got this, turn this whole world into this world of dual truths. And then you're, and that, that completely changes your concept of space. So space, by the way, in Buddhism, is part of the foundation of the mind. It's not part of reality. It's something the mind creates. It's not in reality itself. So space has completely changed. And then you meet timelessness. You sit next to timelessness, and time changes. But then after all that, that incredible mythical description of the nature of enlightenment, what the Buddha does is he raises the whole of the assembly up to exactly the same level. So what this is really communicating for me is enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So not only does the Buddha become enlightened, not only does he see through egotism, not only does he completely let go of all wishing, all wanting, all yearning, and in that moment, letting go of space and time, that is not enough. What he wants is for that to happen to everyone. And that's mythically shown in the sutra by him just raising everybody up so they're on the same level as him, so that they're all partaking in the same experience as him. So Buddhism would say that is our deepest wish. I said that we're wishing beings, that our mind, we have this mind, and our mind wishes, we want, we yearn. And what we wish for is happiness. But we want happiness, unalloyed happiness, and to have that, everyone needs to be happy. Everyone needs to become a Buddha. And in this marvellous, incredible climax of the sutra, you see the deepest wishes of humankind perfected. You see the Buddha becoming the timeless, universal figure that he is, and you see him enlightening the whole of his disciples. So I want to just finish by bringing it down to earth a bit, because perhaps that's too high to end. So I was thinking about, perhaps after all, the Buddha is the ultimate team player. Because what he wants is for everyone to be on the same level. He's not some kind of God figure who's just me. He wants everyone to be on this level. And I've been very struck, I suppose because I've been leading the team on this retreat, I've been really struck by the team, working with the team every day since we arrived. And the special flavour of doing something together, of everybody in the team making their contribution. And together, we've created more than any of us could ever be. We all bring our individual skills and abilities. But together, we've created something a bit closer to the Buddha than any of us are individually. And that's exactly what the Buddha would do. The Buddha would work with a team, as it were, would work with as many people as possible and try and foster all of their particular contributions and skills and rise them up to ever greater, higher and higher levels. So I think perhaps this image of raising up the whole assembly is this thing about that you really want to be enlightened yourself and you really want that for everybody else because you know that's their deepest wish. So that, I believe, is the meaning of this part of the sutra.